before the city council last month, zoo officials guaranteed the Portland City Council that these lots are always full whenever attendance exceeds 4,500. So we have a day here in which the attendance actually exceeds the maximum limit by almost a third, or 2,000 people. And what this aerial photograph clearly shows is that there are approximately 200 empty spaces in the main lot and over 100 empty spaces in the auxiliary lot.
The main lot.
And from that, Mr. Boley, where is the elevator down to the light rail station? Is right there. Okay, thank you.
So, I don't think there's any question that this, but the zoo's own records established that on most days there are hundreds of empty spaces at the zoo parking lot. And there's a lot of detail in what I handed out. I don't want to get into that detail, but I believe that
we can read it. Yeah.
Okay, police supports it. Okay. So I think the challenge is to somehow utilize these empty spaces without conflicting with the parking needs of the zoo, forestry center, and children's museum patrons. I believe that the concerns raised by these institutions are unjustified. They fear any neighbor use because it might lead to lost patron space during peak periods. Also, they don't want to let the camel's head into the tent.
Slippery slope.
Right. Right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Yeah. Thank you.
Up until now, these institutions have been in complete control. The combination of their fear and control is really what brings us here. Ever since the Zoo Max station opened 2.5 years ago, when I became a president of the Neighborhood Association, I have tried to find a workable compromise. My experience is that compromise is not possible. The neighbors have no bargaining leverage and are negotiating with institutions that are not open to compromise. Let me give you an example. In 1999, I made a good neighbor use pilot parking proposal, and you should have copies of that before you. As you can see, the proposal addressed every reasonable concern. It was only a 6-month experiment during the winter. Predetermined problem days, such as weekends, would be excluded. The experiment would be limited to the two adjoining neighborhoods, administered without cost to Metro, and feature parking permits to be hung from rear view mirrors. Parking would be limited to the north portion of the lot, which is usually most vacant. Permit holders would be required to accept all conditions required by Metro. Metro could unilaterally terminate the program upon 30 days' notice. Finally, the program required the approval of all 10 adjoining neighborhoods. The Parking Lot Operations Committee, with a member from each of the three resident institutions, rejected this proposal and declined to make any counter-proposal. My proposal to you is that you fashion something but with the requirement of a report, so that if any of the institution's concerns in fact materialize, you will be able to modify or even eliminate this legislation. As good neighbors, we have endured years of grief, drilling, blasting, and other noisy construction activity that kept people awake and chipped plaster off their walls. All we ask is that the institutions that benefit most from the light rail system reciprocate with a reasonable good neighbor parking agreement. And I'd like to just add two other final points. My understanding is that the city of Portland has two objections. One is that there's an existing lease and that presents a problem. I have reviewed that lease, and in my opinion, this is something which could be dealt with under the terms of the lease, that is a permit program. Secondly, the city raises the question of the land use rules, and I have reviewed that in great detail, and in my opinion, there's just no question but that there is existing state law that clearly allows this type of permit and allows it in a way that supersedes any land use decisions that the city of Portland has made or will make. I just bring that up so that if you would like to ask me questions about that, I can address that.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowley, you're referring to Senate Bill 573 from the 1991 session?
Yes, I am.
Which dealt with, said anything in the final land use agreement that was entered into for the light rail and to ensure the full funding superseded and everybody had to go with that.
Mm. Yes, Representative.
That would then be expressed in the staff report and adopted land use final order?
Yes, Representative Hill, that's correct.
I have copies and I'll distribute out, which I believe then allows explicitly for the adoption of a permit parking program at the zoo to address the concerns associated with the impact on neighborhoods. On the attached page.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vett.
Thank you. Mr. Bowley, how many people, citizens from this neighborhood, would the most number of people who would use this on a semi-regular basis would you get?
Are you talking about Arlington Heights or Arlington Heights?
Well, Arlington Heights is...
And Sylvan Highlands?
Well, I don't know where the neighborhood boundaries are, but I'm assuming, you know, most people aren't going to drive, you know, up from Washington Park to use the zoo station. But, you know, where, how many people do you think would want it? If you had a permit system, how many people would sign up for it?
Yes.
Yeah. 100,000, 20?
It's very difficult to know. I think 100 is a fair guess.
Chair, follow up. So this proposal you presented to the city, did you get a written response back? Was there ever a public hearing?
No.
Nope, they wouldn't. Who were you working with?
Commissioner Francis Coney?
Directly.
He was one of the city officials that I have corresponded with specifically about all these issues. He is the commissioner who is in charge of parks, and it is under his aegis that this lot is managed.
Did you ever get a written response? Your proposal?
No.
I see people nodding affirmatively in this room, but I will probably get to that later. Okay.
Okay.
I'm done for now.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Wong, would you like to go ahead? Foley, were you finished?
Yeah, fine.
Thank you. Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Preston Wong, W-O-N-G for the record. I'm currently a crime prevention specialist with the City of Portland, working with the Northwest neighborhood, specifically Arlington Heights and Sylvan Highlands. Prior to my 4 months as a crime prevention specialist, I was a Portland police officer for 26 years. And what I'm doing here today, and my testimony is going to be fairly brief, is that I'm speaking in favor of public parking at the zoo for the mass transit riders. And the reason for that is just purely public safety. People that use the MAX rail, the system to ride into downtown Portland or west, they're most susceptible to being a victim of a crime, obviously, when they leave their home, point A, and when they're going to point B, wherever that might be, work or downtown or whatever. We've had one instance already, well, two instances of people, women being attacked in Washington Park. The first one was January 15th, happened at 8:15 in the evening, and it was a gal who had just gotten off the MAX light rail at the zoo, and she was walking to her home on the other side of Washington Park. And this was in the evening. She normally doesn't walk that late, but on this particular occasion, she left work and went to a yoga class, and so was running about 2 hours behind her normal schedule. And after she got off the MAX, she was about a little less than a quarter of a mile from the MAX station when a man jumped out of the bushes, grabbed her, drug her down in the embankment where she was raped, and eventually got away. I believe that if there had been public parking at the zoo station there, that an alternative, because she knew she was going to take the class and knew she was going to be walking late at night, that she could conceivably have driven her car, parked in the public space, and then taken the MAX, and on the return trip, done the same thing, and would have avoided the assault and rape in Washington Park. The second attack occurred, I believe, 2, possibly 3 days later. This was in broad daylight hours. And it was a lady jogging through the park, and I'm not sure if she had driven to the area to jog in the park or if she'd left her home, but the idea is the same, that if she had the option of driving to the park, your automobile is a point of safety. That is, you know, for most people, whether you're walking at night or the daytime or whatever, if you can get to your automobile, you know, there's less likelihood of you being a victim of a mugging or a rape. And basically, that's why I'm here testifying in favor of this, of having public parking at the transit station. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative?
Actually, this is kind of, you're all with the, have been associated with apparently the Arlington Heights Neighborhood Association, which is an arm of the city. As a former neighborhood chair, I know we've dealt with the city on numerous occasions in our neighborhood, and we have 2 transit stations and no park and rides, so we all walk to our station. But have you just sent a letter as of yesterday? Presumably, the city council maybe got it today, or it's still in the mail. So this sounds like an ongoing thing. Have you dealt with the neighborhood mediation office and then gone through
Representative March, this is a related but separate issue that is dealt with in this letter, and that is an open space issue as to whether or not that temporary lot should even be parking at all.
Have you worked with the office, the mediation office of the City of Portland?
This was a formal land use case Yes.
No, I'm talking about particularly with your concept here. You haven't gotten satisfaction from the city, so you're bringing your case to the state legislature because your local elected officials haven't responded favorably to your proposal. I'm asking you, have you gone through the process that is set up? They have a mediation service that you can work with. Have you tried that?
Yes.
You've used the mediator.
Well, there wasn't any willingness to pursue that on the part of Commissioner Francis Coney.
Chair?
Representative Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boley, with three governmental entities all having a piece of this in terms of would a city mediation program have any influence over Metro? Would Metro have to agree to something with the city since there's three governmental entities that are separate?
That's a distinct problem. In fact, in this land use case that gives rise to the letter that you have in front of you, one of the issues that the mayor made very clear as a problem is that TriMet wasn't a part of the process. And because TriMet wasn't part of the process, that the city really couldn't get a comprehensive a resolution of the issue. At that same hearing, Commissioner Saltzman emphatically made the point that the problem here is a classic one where shared responsibility becomes no responsibility. The fact that that this is something which is impacted by TriMet, by Metro, by the City of Portland and the Forestry Center, creates a situation where we really have no unified entity that we can deal with.
Okay. Representative Ford.
Thank you. Mr. Wong, you say that you are a crime prevention specialist in the City of Portland?
Yes, for the last 4 months.
So are you speaking then on behalf of the city, or do you have...
No, I'm not speaking on behalf of the city, but as a citizen concerned with public safety and having worked with the people in the surrounding neighborhoods of Washington Park.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other... Representative Beck?
Maybe I misunderstand. It's light rail, 1991, and final order. It says the Highland neighborhood, that it believes the neighborhood that surrounds the zoo station. Is that correct?
There are two neighborhoods that bracket the zoo. Sylvan Highlands is one.
Here. So again, orient everybody to the station. And
all right. Station right here. Okay, this is Southern Highlands. This is Arlington Heights.
Okay, downhill from the station.
Well,
center.
North.
Yeah.
Actually,
north and east and north and south.
Yeah.
This
downhill.
This is an Arlington Heights residence right here.
Right. It says here that the Highland neighborhood has expressed concern that the zoo parking lot would be used as a park and ride lot.
Correct.
Would the Highland neighborhood support your proposal?
Not only will they support it, they have. The next witness is an officer of that neighborhood association and will be presenting to you as evidence, a letter that neighborhood association wrote to a Metro, not only indicating their support, but indicating that it was about 10-1 in favor.
They have no problems with the park and ride lot at this point.
They're very much in favor of it.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Sally Canuva and Andrew Wilson and Don Phillips. And I would like you to speak in that order, please.
Good
already.
Hi, I'm Sally Knuven, and I am Sylvan Highlands Neighborhood Association representative and have served on the board at the time of the letter that you'll be taking a look at issued by our neighborhood association. I'm going to address the committee on several points. One would be safety. One would be the intention of the neighborhood association. And my personal observations as someone who uses the MAX station daily. First of all, on the issue of safety, I personally live about a mile and a quarter from the station in Sylvan Highlands neighborhood. And every day at 6:19 a.m., I drive my son to use the MAX, a 15-year-old, using the MAX station to get to school in Clackamas, and every day at 4 o'clock I pick him up at the MAX station at the zoo. And this began in August of this year. He began riding the MAX, connecting up with the bus, so we don't have to drive to Clackamas every day. When the attack occurred really close to the station, I became very concerned as a parent that my child was not being supervised at that station. And I personally get on the elevator, get out of my car, get on the elevator, and go down into the station with him every morning and see him get on MAX and then do the same in the afternoon. So I can certainly understand the perspective of anybody who's concerned about the safety of themselves or of a child or anyone while they're using the MAX station, because there's the only way to access the station is either to drop someone off or to catch a bus to get there. There's just no way to park on site. My husband also is a commuter who works downtown. He can't ride MAX because he has no place to park, so he drives his car and parks downtown every day. So it's not, even for a very close person, I mean, you would think that this MAX station would be at least made accessible for those who are close by, but I'm telling you that I cannot use this station in a practical way without driving a car to get there. As an officer of Sylvan Highlands Neighborhood Association, I was present at the meeting where this vote was taken, and I can tell you the history. I have been active in the Neighborhood Association since I moved to Sylvan Highlands in 1997, and we have the issue of parking at the zoo has come up many times. This particular time we took a vote to decide whether or not we wanted to support the issue of parking at the zoo, and you can see recorded in the second paragraph, the concept of shared parking was overwhelmingly supported, and our determination to pursue a good neighbor use parking lot policy was endorsed by 9 out of 10 neighbors. Representative Beck, when you asked about opposition to this, there have been some immediate neighbors who live on the other side of the parking lot that was just converted from temporary to permanent this past month. I'm sure Jeff pointed it out. It's the lower left parking lot. People who live right behind that parking lot are concerned about lights coming through the windows, and they've been assured that there will be proper planting and you know, whatever kind of mitigation needs to be done to make sure that their homes aren't affected. They're concerned about that, and also I think, well, I can't really address all their issues because I haven't heard them, but it's a very small group of people who don't attend neighborhood association meetings, and so I'm not quite sure what all their concerns are, but it's a few people. The third thing is my observations, my personal observations about how that lot is used, and I testified last month in front of City Council about this, that I have been using that facility since August of this year, and we're into April now, and I have never seen the lot full. And, you know, I imagine that in the summertime it is very busy over there, but I know that the proposal has been to allow shared-use parking, and if the lot's full, then those who have parking permits can't park there. So I don't see the problem. I think it would be a great idea to get cars off the road, and I know, too, in our household that would be off the road if this parking were allowed. So I thank you for your consideration of it.
Thank you. In the interest of time, committee, I'm going to just have each person go ahead and testify, and then if you have questions, you can address either one. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andrew Wilson. I live in the Wilcox West neighborhood, which is located off of the Sylvan exit from the Sunset Highway, the south side, immediate south side of the highway. I work in Representative Hill's district at Intel. My little show and tell prop here, it's an Intel badge, which no doubt you can't see on the back because it's very small. There is an Intel-provided TriMet transportation pass, which I personally have been trying to use for 2.5 years since the West Side Max opened up, and to avoid driving a single occupancy car into Representative Hill's district every day. But the problem is the only MAX station that's accessible to our neighborhood is the one at the zoo, and you understand the problem that has been presented since there is no parking available at that facility. Now, I was also a member of the board of the Wilcox West Board of Directors in 1998 and 1999 when West Side Light Rail opened up, and we had a very extensive set of conversations with TriMet, with Metro, and actually with the school district, because there's also the related issue of the lack of transit for Lincoln High School students in this district. So to address Representative March's question, is this a new issue, or have the neighborhood groups been working through the process? And the answer is there's quite a history of attempting to work through the process, but there are actually four governmental agencies involved: the city, Metro, TriMet, and the school district, all of whom have a little piece of this problem, and none of whom seem to be able to be responsive to the citizens in this area. So, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee. I'm John Phillips, legislative assistant for Representative Jim Hill. And I brought with me today a letter from Gail Ackerman, who's a neighbor and well-known to, I'm sure, a few of you on the committee. And I'll just go through some of the highlights of her letter. She wanted me to read it into the record for you this morning. I live within about a mile and a half of the zoo. When the weather is good and I have time, I sometimes walk to the zoo light rail station and take Max to my office in the Lloyd District. Most of the time, I end up driving instead. I've talked to Metro and TriMet officials about the parking prohibition. I understand Metro's desire to have the lot available for use by zoo patrons, but significant amounts of state funds were used to pay for the extraordinary expensive station at Washington Park. This expense was justified to encourage people to use light rail to reach the zoo and other facilities. I understand, however, that a disappointingly small number of zoo visitors actually use MAX. The figures I have heard range from highs of 40% to averages.
have before you the complete text of 803-18-AAB. But within the statutory makeup of 803-18-AAB, the statute provides that the statement has to be reliable, and it sets out how to determine reliability. It also talks about corroboration and how the statement has to be corroborated. So the judge, for instance, in a pretrial hearing or outside the presence of the jury, would go through all this. And for instance, you have to, the state would have to call witnesses, potentially the person themselves or the doctor or a caregiver. And we'd have to jump through these statutory hurdles, if you will, before the judge would allow this into evidence. And that's how the defendant's confrontation clause that's how his confrontation clause issues are protected, because the court has to make those findings. Now, for those victims who are 65 years of age and older, who are in great health and have no mental problems, they will be witnesses in court. So they will be subject to cross-examination. So the fact that they're testifying and their statements they made to third parties would come in isn't a problem either, because, again, the person, the witness himself, is there in the courtroom to be cross-examined. So that's not really a problem either. So either way, the suspect's rights are protected. Plus, if you have a victim who is 65 years of age or older who isn't going to be a good witness or isn't a competent witness, then this allows those cases to be successfully prosecuted. And, you know, some children 12 years of age and younger, I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years old who are outstanding witnesses. And I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years older who are even confident. And the same thing applies to people 65 years of age and older. We hope that our elder population gets old and is healthy and is competent. But we know at some point in time everybody's health begins to fail. And unfortunately, in elder abuse cases, here's the glitch. The people who become victims in elder abuse cases already have some vulnerability, and that's what makes them victims. That's what makes them susceptible to elder abuse. They're already frail, or they're already mentally diminishing. They're maybe already suffering from maybe some dementia. They may have very lucid moments most of the day, but they're vulnerable to a stranger, or maybe they're vulnerable to a family member or a relative that they're close to. But that's what, that in most of your cases starts it. And so that's, this is why this statute protects those folks.
One of the central issues in this next decade.
Any further discussion?
And Greg, your point.
Okay,
about,
thank you very much. Hearing none, we'll public hearing on Senate Bill 780. That completes our agenda for today. We won't be working any of these bills today.
It's important for us to the assessment of knowledge that we have to maintain here. So it's definitely a community effort around power. And another one, Senator Ferrioli mentioned, is that when you take a look at the historical development of our county, I would argue that the county that we have the most similar historical development to is Grant County there. The development of both counties basically being on the discovery of gold and the wealth created from that, and then the communities that grew and then the agricultural support from there on out. Alisa Bonebreak, our librarian, always has some interesting insights, and I had not considered this before today. But I think the fact that the Idaho border is currently represented by 3 state senators is really significant there. I think the alternative would be 1 or 2. I think the more representation we can get on this part of the state, the better. I'm inclined to agree with her there. And then finally, I would just, I don't know that the Baker Moore Regional Partnership is necessarily in jeopardy as a result of any configuration here. But you're absolutely right, Representative Smith, that it's going very well. And our interest with Morrow County is basically focusing on getting things done that will make a difference. That's what Baker County's been about for the past decade, and that's why we want to be in a district that allows us to keep getting that done. Thanks again for being here.
There you go. We'll be the best attorney. This has really been good. It's been good for me, it's been good for all of us. I hope it was good for you. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. actually they're constitutional. The Constitution, one person, one vote. The question was asked, is there a mechanism for distributing the representation by a mechanism other than population? And originally in Oregon's history, we had a distribution other than by population. Then it was districted by geography. But in pursuit of some judicial review, it was determined that the only constitutional configuration for Oregon was one person, one vote, meaning that you had to have proportionality between the House districts, two of them, of roughly equal population, and the Senate district, which would be one of them. And so we ended up with a constitutional interpretation that that requires that each senator represent approximately the same number of voters, and that each member of the House of Representatives also represent an equal number of voters. And that was the comment that the chairman made, one person, one vote. So that each senator meets on a roughly equal plane. That way, in the Senate, when I speak for you, my vote in the Senate carries equal weight to a senator from Portland, whose district may only be 20 blocks in one direction, as opposed to 6.5 hours in one direction. Obviously, we are outnumbered by population since it's centered in the Willamette Valley. The equation that Senator Harper and I look at in the Senate every day is that there are three Eastern Oregon senators and one Central Oregon senator that we include, which is really nice. And so there's four of us east of the Cascades in the Senate that represent your interests, and there are eight members in the House that represent your interests east of the Cascades. So obviously, we need to be very supportive of each other in our interests and be very vocal about your interests there. And that's why the communality of interests is not a trivial issue, it's very important issue. So I have been perfectly happy with the idea of, okay, how about 36 senators? We could put another row in the back of the Senate and have one senator per county. And the problem there is then that you'd have one senator for Multnomah County, one senator for Clackamas, Washington, et cetera, and they represent, the six counties represent half the population of the state of Oregon. And you would be a,
what's
would,
the problem?
Yeah. You would not have the constitutional issue of one person, one vote in that case. But we have, in fact, experimented. You know, the Constitution of Oregon has been interpreted to be one person, one vote, but not the Constitution of the United States. There's two senators per state, no matter what the size of the population. I kind of like that idea myself. But. It would take an initiative, ma'am, to change the Constitution.
I'm just trying to get this done based on travel.
Oh, take the easy way out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thanks for coming this way. Let me tell you.